Welcome to A Better Future for All in conversation with Kerry O'Brien, presented by Griffith University and HODA, Home of the Arts, on the Gold Coast.
Anastasia Palaszczuk, thank you very much for making the time for this conversation. An hour is generous and it'll go quickly. I'm keen to explore what you're going to do with the unique opportunity that you have in this term of government, Queensland's first fixed four-year term, with a working majority and no upper house to get in the way.
Excellent.
I thought you might say that. But since the pandemic continues to dominate all else, I think we need to start there. The vaccines rollout is about to start, and although it will be run from Canberra, the states will obviously be critical to a success. I assume that you and all the other premiers have been kept fully briefed. What outcome are you expecting for Queensland in terms of the effectiveness of the rollout?
Well, we've started off with a very tough question already, Kerry, and I think the rollout of the vaccine is really important. It's something that we're all very much looking forward to, and I'm going to be encouraging everyone to get the vaccine as well. If Dr. Young said to me it's safe to get it, I'm going to be getting it, and I think everyone else should as well. And we have to do it. We're in extraordinary times, and if we want to get to some sort of back to how life was, it's absolutely crucial. So later this month, the Pfizer vaccine will come, and then that'll be followed by AstraZeneca. And of course, the key here is distribution. Mm. How do we get it out to so many places across Queensland, which is so decentralised? It's going to be very complex. All the details are being worked through at the moment. Professor Murphy has actually asked us to send someone from each state and territory and embed themselves in Canberra so we can be confident that the vaccine rollout will be done according to schedule. But of course, it's up to the federal government to get the supply. What we don't know is what's going to happen in the future. And I just read a study the other day about what's happening over in Boston and the Harvard Medical School, where they're seeing this virus mutate. And as it mutates, it's actually avoiding the antibodies that are produced in the body. So this is very complex. It's changing all the time. So I think it's really important that we get vaccinated as quickly as possible to stop the virus from mutating.
So obviously the end goal is herd immunity. The end goal is a point where only a small percentage of the population is still immune, is still vulnerable. Do you think we can get there this year?
I do, in terms of the rollout of the vaccine, but then we're going to have to see how that goes. We're seeing some good evidence initially out of the UK that it's starting to see a trend of the virus. We are hearing it's effective against the UK strain. We need more evidence in about the South American strain and the South African strain.
Yeah.
These are unknowns.
And that's just the strains now.
And I think we sort of got to understand COVID in its original form early on over the last 12 months. But now with the UK strain, and the people here would have seen how we had to do a sudden and quick lockdown when the Hotel Grand Chancellor, we had a community positive person with that UK strain, which came from hotel quarantine. We're now seeing what's happening in Melbourne. And we've also had issues over in Perth. This is the unknown. So we all have to work together. We all have to be united as a country, but we have to deal with these issues quickly, because if this strain is 70% more contagious, we need to act quickly, because the quarantine is our last line of defence.
Well, I was watching the health experts at the press club a couple of days ago. And one of them was talking about the need. If we're going to actually get this vaccine on the schedule, it's going to be something like 160,000 to 190,000 vaccinations a week nationally. And for Queensland, on my rough maths, and I'm not sure how many children v adults there are in Queensland, but you're probably talking 15,000 to 20,000 people a week. Can you do that?
Well, the Commonwealth has to put out the schedule. And there's a whole network of GPs out there. What they are seeing in some other countries is that they're using convention centres to get the mass vaccination happening. So all of this finite detail needs to be worked out, and that is what the federal government needs to do. But as a state, we are entering into bilaterals with the federal government about the rollout. The states have good service delivery, and I'm very confident that by working together, we can affect a rollout. But of course, we need the supply of the AstraZeneca, which the large majority of it's going to be manufactured in Melbourne, is my understanding. And of course, we need the supply of the Pfizer. So that is the federal government's responsibility.
All right.
Now, and a good communications campaign, because there are a lot of people out there. We've got good rates of immunisation in Queensland for vaccination. But I'm very concerned that if the communications campaign is not solid, there'll be people who won't go and get the vaccine.
Now, you're at pains to stress the Commonwealth's overall responsibility, and I would be sympathetic to that. I would imagine any state premier will be saying exactly the same thing. But where does your responsibility begin and end? I mean, because I can imagine what happens. You're talking about the need for unity on this as much as anything. What happens if something goes wrong? What happens if one state's rollout seems to be slower than others? I mean, are we going to start seeing the blame game taking place there?
Well,
are you going to be saying, if it happens in Queensland, are you going to be saying, well, that's the Commonwealth, and they're going to be saying, actually,
well,
it's you?
Well, I think if we go back to look at quarantine, and let's be honest here, we never thought our hotels for tourists and business people were going to be used for quarantining people returning from overseas with a virus. Our hotels were never built for that. And all of the states were able to very, very quickly upgrade to put in place quarantine measures.
Somewhat imperfectly.
Well,
to one degree or another, from one state to another.
Yeah, sure, but this is brand new for governments. Mm. I didn't know 18 months ago, or you know, from before we declared a state emergency at the end of health emergency at the end of January last year, that we were going to have to set up hotels for quarantine. I mean, this is an extraordinary time we are living in, with extraordinary circumstances. And I think the National Cabinet has served a really good purpose in that we've been able to come together and discuss these issues, where you have Professor Murphy, you have the Chief Health Officer giving us all the most up-to-date information. Plus, we also have the head of Treasury and the head of the Reserve Bank, who also update us regularly on the state of the economy.
Mm. And so this is the other big half of the equation. This is the economy. So let's say herd immunity is achieved within Queensland and the rest of Australia. How confident can you be that that will mean immunity from all strains, which you just touched on it briefly, of COVID-19 potentially coming in from overseas?
Well, they're the big questions, aren't they? I think because we've seen massive lockdowns overseas where the virus has gotten out of control, where governments overseas have failed to take health as their number one objective and let the economy run, we've seen what's happened. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of deaths, especially in the US, quite absolutely tragic.
Mm.
Where governments here, for example, have taken quick and swift action, focusing on health first, our economy has been able to recover faster. That's just the reality.
But there's still a lot of big question marks about what that means, about how real that recovery is and how sustainable that recovery is. One of the things that I wonder whether we're going to drop, I mean, we, the public generally now, are going to be inclined to drop the ball a little bit in terms of our own awareness as we get this sense that the vaccine is rolling out, somehow or other it's all going to be just about over. I mean, the cases are still going to be coming in from overseas. They're still going to leach out of the quarantine system, aren't they?
Well, that's where I think we cannot be complacent. So even when our quarantine workers will have the vaccine, I think we still have to have precautions in place, because we just don't know how the mutation is going to be.
Mm.
But I think the world is very much focused on getting the planet vaccinated. I mean, we've heard World Health Organization commentary on how it's absolute a priority to vaccinate as quickly as possible.
Do you think most Queenslanders feel enough urgency now about the need to vaccinate, particularly those who haven't been directly touched by it?
I think that's where you need a very effective communications campaign, but also too, Queenslanders have done everything that we have asked them to do during this pandemic, and we would not be in the situation we are today if it wasn't for the fact that Queenslanders have stepped up every single time during the pandemic, whether that was having to close businesses, having to stay at home, having, not being able to see relatives, not being able to go to church. I mean, these are, like, our whole world was turned upside down. And now, as the Chief Health Officer said to me, she said, "Premier, I can see light at the end of the tunnel. I can see a way out of this pandemic with the vaccine." And I think that public need to have absolute confidence that the TGA does not approve a vaccine. It goes through all the processes completely independent of the political process, and they will not tick off a vaccine unless they deem it to be safe.
So I assume you're as well briefed as anyone in the country. And the other aspect of all of this is that there's no guarantee that there won't be further border closures either here or between two of the other states right through this process.
That's correct. I mean, we're monitoring the situation in Melbourne at the moment. We're having another briefing at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning where we get the most up-to-date information, and we are monitoring to see if there is any community transmission that's happening.
And that could still be the case 3 months from now, 4 months from now. We might be a certain way into the rollout, but these flare-ups will still be potentially possible even in 4 or 5 or 6 months' time.
You're absolutely correct. But I think what we did when we had the lockdown for the Greater Brisbane region, it actually worked incredibly well that people listened. But I actually asked the National Cabinet, I said, "We're declaring this a hotspot. I'm asking everywhere else across the country to also declare it a hotspot." I think that worked incredibly well.
But I'm getting to the economy next.
Yes.
And that's the context in which I'm asking this, because of course we've got that huge problem in terms of international exchange of goods and passengers and so on. But the domestic economy has also been severely disrupted, and your tourism industry in Queensland is a classic case in point.
The tourism industry has absolutely been impacted.
So there's still going to be no certainty for any of these big industries, big businesses, small businesses, right through Australia and right through Queensland.
That's correct, but can I give you some other examples? The fact that we've been able to contain the virus, where we have basically no community transmission in Queensland. Our construction companies have continued. Tomorrow I'll be making an announcement down here on the Gold Coast. More jobs, people working. Our mining has been able to continue. Our small businesses have been able to continue. In South America, mining has been shut down. In the UK, businesses have been shut down. In Europe, tourism has been shut down. So they're the economies that are suffering far greater than Australia, where we've been able to contain that virus. However, the international borders remain closed for tourists, and that is having a big impact on the Gold Coast here. It's having a big impact in Cairns. I was up in Cairns speaking with tourism operators just recently, and in the Whitsunday Mackay region. And I've actually asked the Prime Minister to extend JobKeeper past the end of March or have targeted assistance for those industries that are still going to feel the impacts of having international borders shut. And I absolutely support having the international borders shut, but we need to recognise that some people's businesses are impacted because of that.
And what's your sense of the likely response to that?
Well, that'll be a no. But but I think there will be some movement in terms of, I heard one of the federal ministers say they are looking at some targeted support, and we are also looking at what we can do as a government a little bit more to encourage tourism to certain destinations. So
They'll have to be looking for targets, because it's going to be an election year, federally.
Well, yes, well, the Prime Minister has been very nice recently, so you might be right there, Kerry.
So, but through all of this, I mean, we are still a long way from opening the borders to other countries, either for people or for produce. So that is still a massive impediment to the return to a healthy economy for Australia. So given all of the kind of the intelligence that you've got, the economic intelligence as well as health, what is a reasonable expectation of when you might look ahead and when Australian business might look ahead to our international borders opening? Is that herd immunity a possibility, serious possibility, that you are countenancing before the end of this year?
Well, international borders is federal, so...
You've got a big stake in it.
Yeah, I do have a big stake in it. But until we see countries that have vaccination that is widely accepted, and until we have more evidence about these other strains, I think the world is going to be still quite an uncertain place for the foreseeable future.
In terms of a reasonably free flow of imports coming into Australia, quite apart from the flow of people?
Well, even that, I mean, we are monitoring and we do testing of our maritime workers coming in and out. We had issues where people were testing positive to COVID who've been on small yachts coming in. These are all issues. Like, you've got your Pacific Islands where you could say some of them are like your green zones at the moment where there's no COVID, but you still have shipping going into those ports. You still have people sailing around. I mean, it's very, very complex. Mm. But I hopefully, with the vaccine rollout and as it moves through other countries and we get more and more evidence, well, then there may be more confidence that we can actually deal with certain countries. But I think that's an issue that the federal government needs to look at in the first place.
Mm. And yeah. I'm not wanting to sound like the eternal Jeremiah through this conversation, yeah. but we are a long way from out of the woods economically.
We are, and I absolutely agree with that. Mm. And that's why governments have put in huge stimulus packages. We put in $11
billion.
We're targeting $11 billion. We're targeting specific industries as well. And I think you're seeing a whole lot of infrastructure investment that's happening across Australia, the likes of which, you know, we've never seen in our lifetime.
So let's jump ahead to this moment when we are kind of, we're back into the beginnings of a relatively smoothly running economy. I suspect a lot of people have forgotten that the national economy was close to recession anyway before the pandemic struck. And at the heart of that struggling national growth was stagnating wages. Something even that fundamentally conservative institution, the Reserve Bank, tries to keep reminding us about today, and they have been doing for 2 years. On top of that, no one knows what the impact will be when the federal government turns off the JobKeeper tap. Then there's the mountain of debt and deficit that will put pressure on governments to keep spending tight. So how does Queensland plan its way out of it with all of these impediments and the stagnating wages, as a for instance, is embedded in our system? No one's really quite sure why it is like that. But workers' wages simply are not growing and haven't been growing for about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I think they're all very important issues. And if I can put it in this context, so before COVID hit, since my government was elected, I think we had grown around 250,000 jobs. So we were getting to be in a really good position. International tourism was coming in, international students, the economy, our resources sector was booming, our exports were record high. We'd grown it from $40 billion to nearly $80 billion. And then COVID struck and 200,000 jobs were lost. Well, now we've grown back those jobs. We're now at 272,000 jobs, but we still recognise that there are industries that are hurting. So what does government do? Well, you need big stimulus. You need investment in job-generating infrastructure, which is what we're absolutely looking at with a $50 billion pipeline across the state. We have the most decentralised state. I need to make sure we've got hospitals and schools, so we need to continue to grow. But I think there is a huge appetite that Queensland can come out of this quite strong because it's a safe place to invest because of our COVID response. But also, too, what we're seeing, Kerry, is we're seeing, you know, net migration to Queensland from other states. So I
think that'll keep coming?
I think it will. Well, why wouldn't it? I mean, you only have to look around the Gold Coast. Yeah. I mean, just driving into Broadbeach today, all of the cranes on the horizon. I mean, the construction industry here has not stopped. If you go to the Gold Coast, the Sunshine Coast, around Brisbane, people are buying properties. They're not even coming up for inspections. They're actually buying them through Zoom call meetings. It is phenomenal. And our stamp duty has gone up 17%.
I don't know that you should boast about stamp duty.
Well,
Not when there are so many young people who can't afford to buy their first home.
We have a home first homeowner's grant as well, so we are looking after those people.
And be careful what you wish for on the growth, because in the previous growth spurt in southeast Queensland, Labor governments ran out of they weren't able to keep up with the infrastructure. I can remember that massive sudden spend on the freeways around Brisbane, trying desperately to catch up.
Well, drive along the M1, you'll see a lot of work happening there. We're going to be building a second M1. Go up the Bruce Highway, you'll see a lot of construction happening all the way up to Cairns.
And schools and hospitals and all the other, the sewerage and all the other things that go with it. At a time when, as we come out of this, you're going to have to start worrying about your budgets again. And while you talk about the need for great stimulus, there are going to be those worry warts looking over your shoulder at the same time saying, look at the size of your deficit, look at the size of debt.
Well, we also have the Governor of the Reserve Bank and the Head of Treasury saying now is the time to borrow, to invest in infrastructure. Record low interest rates, now is the time to do it. And that is the message that they are sending to every state premier and territory minister.
So what is going to turbocharge your growth? And you need to start that turbocharge process soon, don't you, rather than waiting for the herd immunity thing to happen and not knowing exactly to the extent to which Scott Morrison is going to keep that federal money flowing. What is going to turbocharge your economy? What is it that's going to put the floor... And is it really just going to be public spending on infrastructure?
It's not just public infrastructure, I think. I think Queensland is going to be really appealing to investors from around the world. A, it's a safe place to invest. And B, people can actually work in this economy. People are not working in parts of the Northern Hemisphere at the moment. So I think you are going to see a lot more investment attraction coming here to Queensland. But also too, you only have to look at what's happening around the world at the moment, and a huge interest in hydrogen. And I honestly believe that Queensland is at the forefront of being able to capitalise on a multi-billion dollar hydrogen industry, which is what the economies of Japan and South Korea are hungry for.
Well, I'll come back to that because I'm extremely interested to hear something more solid about that. So I want to come to leadership now. What was the most difficult test of your leadership through the pandemic thus far?
Well, there were a few. I think that probably everybody attacking me, yelling at me, demanding that I do something that I knew was not the right thing to do, and I stood my ground.
Was this about keeping your border open or not?
It was about keeping our border closed, and at a time when everyone was demanding it to be open, we could have had what Victoria experienced in terms of a second wave.
Now, I'm genuinely not being cynical here, but I do know that you can't separate politics from policy, and that doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that you're not always looking for the right decision to make. But you could not have separated the politics from the policy in this last year because it was an election year. And now, you and I both understand, and you're so steeped in the politics of this place that you would have understood the nature of Queenslanders' dislike of being told what to do or bossed around from the south. And I'm sure that your gut instinct would have been that even if it was the right thing to do, it was also going to be the thing that was your pathway to an election victory where otherwise you were facing defeat?
I reject that because I honestly, to me, since the very day that we deemed to have a state of health emergency in Queensland, we were the first state to do that, it was always on about keeping Queenslanders safe. Now, I have parents in my 70s, and at the time my grandmother was alive as well, and she was in a nursing home. And, of course, the nursing homes was deemed as some of the most vulnerable. And tragically, she passed away middle of last year. And no one wants their family to suffer. And I have always prided myself in listening to expert advice. So when we have droughts or floods or fires, I've always listened to the experts. And Dr. Young is perhaps the most seasoned chief health officer in this country. She was around when the SARS pandemic was first started as well. And I will always listen to her advice. And that was her advice.
Now, I don't imagine...
And her advice was correct because we saw what happened in Victoria.
But once you had decided to plot that path, and again, I'm not trying to reduce the achievements, but once you had decided to plot that path, that made the process relatively easy, didn't it? Because if you're saying, I'm going to listen to the advice from this person and the
Kerry,
people behind
there
her...
There were many in my own party that didn't agree with me.
How bad was that? I'm going to say bad.
Well,
how strong was that?
It wasn't just one side of politics. There was a lot of side of politics and a lot of people.
And how tough did that get?
It was very tough, but I stood my ground.
Was there a point in the caucus where there would have... I mean, what was the breakdown in caucus? How many people in caucus disagreed with what you were doing?
Oh, I'm not saying that there was verbal disagreements, but I know that there were people who, in the party, in the bureaucracy, right across the board, that were concerned with the stand I was taking and the impact that was having on industries. So when you're up against all that pressure from not just outside but from within, and you stand your ground and you get through it, at the end of the day, I'm very proud of where we are.
And just in terms of that internal battle in you, I guess, and trying to work out on your own mind, which voices ultimately to listen to and be influenced most by, what was the point where you actually breathed a sigh of relief and relaxed and thought, I've got it right, I've gone the right way here?
I haven't relaxed yet.
But you do feel that you've gone the right way.
Every single day. Well, look, we're all here tonight.
Yeah.
We're all sitting here tonight in a nearly packed auditorium. You've been able to come up from...
Yes, you allowed me to do
South
that.
Wales.
Yes. There was a point where I wondered whether you'd let me across the border, but...
But honestly, you know, I think Queenslanders value their health, their family, having a job and lifestyle. And we have all of that happening at the moment in our state.
Hmm. But at a certain point... In the course of last year, the internal polling that your party was no doubt taking through this process was telling you that politically you had taken the right steps.
Well...
Just say yes.
No. No, that's not absolutely correct, because I can actually talk to people, and I travel a lot across Queensland and I listen. I think I pride myself... on that, and people were coming up to me saying to me, thank you for keeping us safe. I get handwritten notes given to me at coffee shops, thank you for keeping us safe. Emails, personally handwritten made cards, you know. I think the public understand how important this is during a global pandemic.
And for once, you crossed, you reached across a political divide, didn't you, in terms of the, when it suddenly showed up on election night that you were taking votes from One Nation, for heaven's sake. What was that about? What was that about? That was older people who had become traditional One Nation voters saying thank you for keeping us safe because we feel vulnerable.
But
that was pretty much it, wasn't
it? But not only that, there were Liberal voters who have never voted Labor in their life, and they voted Labor for the very first time because we kept them safe.
And were they people of a certain age too? Were they people who were vulnerable?
Across the board.
Yeah.
Across the board.
So the bottom line is that you have garnered a great deal of political capital as a result of that leadership and the perceptions of that leadership through the pandemic. So what does a good leader do with that political capital, with the numbers, in a one-house parliament and 4 years of guaranteed government? What do you do with that? What advantage are you going to take of that? Let's just put the economy to one side.
Yep. That's the biggest challenge at the moment.
The rest of your agenda.
Yep.
What are you going to do that you can walk away with at the end of the 4 years, regardless of how the rest of the state reads it, and feel good about yourself?
Well, I think over the 4 years, we need to get as much through the pandemic as we possibly can. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't sit here and tell you all what's going to happen in 2 or 3 or 4 years' time. We have to just plan to the best of our capability. I'd like to see a more equal Queensland. I'll give you this one example. This is something I looked at the other day, and I'll just make some comments on it. So I was standing the other day at a press conference. There was myself, the health minister, the police commissioner, and we're all standing there, and I looked around and I thought to myself, it's all women. And then I said to someone in my office, I said, did you realise that press conference? I never thought I'd see the day where all the four people speaking at the press conference were women. And he said, I didn't even notice. Because it's become normal. Because it's become normal. And to have a cabinet 50% when we were first elected as well, I think we're just one off at the moment. But if you add in our assistant ministry, we are. We've got more women in our public service. And I think that sends a message that if you want to talk about equality, you've got to practice it. And I tell every young girl, including my nieces, be strong, be confident, have opportunity.
Now, that's something that's happening. And I must say, you reminded me of a conversation I had on stage with Julie Bishop not long after she stepped away from politics. And so she was speaking rather candidly for the first time about this stuff. And she described how invisible and unheard she felt like in the cabinet room of the ministries she served in.
But that's not in my cabinet.
Yes.
In my cabinet, everyone is equal. Everyone gets a say.
Now, this might or might not be a hard one.
It should be everywhere else. It should be in our... Mm. We're doing that. We've got 50% on our government boards, but it should become the norm everywhere. It's reflective of society.
What difference...
Would it be lovely if that was in the federal parliament?
What difference does it make?
The federal cabinet.
What difference does it make, do you think, in terms of the quality of the outcomes?
Oh, much better outcomes. Much better.
But do you under... Yes, but tell me...
Very much across the detail as well,
Kerry. Tell me how you identify what that is. What is the quality of outcome that is different or better now as a result of there being more women with input to the process? And what is it? Are you able to pinpoint something that women bring to the table that men may be less inclined to or less able to?
Well, if we're talking about equality, it's about having all voices around the table. We also have our first Indigenous minister, Leanne Enoch, who sits around that table. I like to see more people from a multicultural background sitting around that table. You've got to have diversity and you've got to have those voices there, otherwise the voices are unheard. Now, I go back to when I first joined COAG, I was the only woman. So, you know, I went along to one of my first COAG meetings. And they made some comment about, how does it feel to be the only chick? This was from a journalist. And, you know, which I thought was quite offensive.
You've also, I know that you've, in the past, you've expressed concern, or observed rather pungently, about the capacity of the media, or the tendency in the media to report female politicians differently to male. And I think one example you gave is how if male politicians are attending a meeting, it's an important conference or it's a summit, women have dates. Women politicians have dates.
Well, I'll give you a good example. So Tony Abbott had a catch up with Alan Jones. It was a powerful meeting.
A powerful meeting.
Powerful meeting. I caught up with Alan Jones and we were on a date. That's how the media portrayed it. Now, everyone knows that's not possible.
What are the...
And just to your comment on Julie Bishop...
You operate at various levels, don't you?
Just on Julie Bishop. Julie Bishop left office and I got along very well with Julie. I met her a couple of times and we had good conversations. And, you know, she was a very effective foreign affairs minister. And when she left, they talked about her shoes.
Hmm.
Disgusting. And after that, I made a comment at an International Women's Day breakfast and I said, it's not the shoes you stand in, it's what you stand for.
Hmm. But what does that say? What does that say about how far we have come as a society 50 years after the modern renaissance of feminism? 50 years after the 70s feminist revolution, you're still talking about that kind of stuff.
Well, that was the media commentating on that. But I think when you have more women involved in the political process, it actually changes the conversation. And right. When you were saying before, what are the outcomes of that? Well, you get much better outcomes because women are involved in all different aspects of society and life, and they bring that to the table, and they bring it with gusto as well. All of the men who are on our cabinet table, sit there on our cabinet table as well, they're good men, and they want great outcomes as well. And you have robust conversations, and at the end of that day, end of that meeting, we come out absolutely united in what we want to do for the people.
And
of
you
this
never
state.
You never see the sexist card around that table?
No, I might have seen it in the past.
I thought you were going to say I might have seen it in the party room.
No, in the past. But I can remember clearly when I was a younger person going to a meeting once and I was asked to leave a meeting. And I looked around and I thought, why am I being asked to leave this meeting? I was the only woman at that meeting and I was singled out to leave that meeting.
How'd you handle that? You had to leave.
Made me stronger.
Yeah, okay.
It never happened again and I got an apology.
I'm the one who can see the clock on the stage here, so I'm very conscious of time passing and I want to try and keep it moving along. But what are the hallmarks of good leadership for you? And in terms of in laying that out, if you can give me a sense of the kinds of other leaders that might have influenced or helped shape your view of what good leadership is.
Okay, I think, so going back many years ago, that's a very good question. Going back years ago, I suppose I couldn't see many role models in Australia. So when I went over to the US in 92, I was observing the Clinton campaign and I met Dianne Feinstein, who was running for the Senate. And she did this debate and I thought, oh my goodness, if she can debate like this, perhaps one day I could do that. So you cannot be what you cannot see. So I saw that. Then years later...
But what was it about her that caught you?
Oh, it was just her boldness, the way she debated, and it was just two people standing on stage equally debating each other. So I learned from that. Then Bob Hawke, I think, consensus sort of leadership, I really liked that and I hope I put that into practice. And he was always out with the people, and I try to get out as much as possible and talk to people. Because if you're listening and you're responding, I think that makes you a better leader. And then Wayne Goss, who's no longer with us, I really admired him as a former Queensland Premier for his policy depth and analysis.
The other side of that coin, though, was, and he was the Labor leader who led Labor out of the Bjelke-Petersen wilderness.
Exactly, yeah.
But he only lasted, I think, 5 years. And he was marked down by the voters because I can remember covering that election night.
I think it was just over six.
Six, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
I remember, perhaps I remember the election night better. But but I do remember that local analysts were marking him down on arrogance. They were saying that he was being punished for perceptions of arrogance.
But I think people may have had the wrong perception of him because I don't think it was arrogant. I think he was actually quite shy. And it was his, just the way in which he interacted with people. If you're shy, you might then, people might perceive that as being arrogant.
Mm.
So that's just a commentary from me because I knew him and he was very pleasant. And when we were reduced to seven members after the election where Campbell Newman won, I was trying not to mention his name for the whole night.
I think you should mention his name often because he did you an enormous favour.
And
who else would you have wanted to have as the head of government while you were trying to come back from seven members?
True. But, yeah, we were only seven members and all the jokes were made about seven members. And I went and saw Wayne and he sat down with me and he sat there for an hour. And I remember walking into his office and just chatting with him and he said to me, "Good luck." And I said, "Thanks."
Well, I'm pleased that's all you need.
I still keep in contact with Rojing. Yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah. Of course, then there was Paul Keating. When you talk about Bob Hawke, I mean, Bob Hawke was like he had the common touch like nobody else. It was quite extraordinary to watch him at work. Paul Keating, on the other hand, said that while Bob was tripping over television cables in the shopping centres of Australia building the political capital, he was spending it. And really, really, yeah. When you're looking at the leadership of one, you're looking at the leadership of both, aren't you? Because they were a very important
absolutely.
Double act.
Absolutely. A great team. And Paul Keating, like in the parliament, would just tear up his opponents. But I think what Paul has had a unique ability to do, complex arguments and complex issues, to really explain that to people very clearly.
Hmm.
So whether you liked him or you didn't like him, at least you understood exactly where he stood on the political spectrum on particular issues.
But so he would spend the capital. It was always important to him to do that. He could see no point in garnering the chestnuts and hoarding them into a corner and then just waiting to build to win your next election and then hoarding the chestnuts and waiting to win the next election. In other words, to him there was no point in being in government unless you spent that political capital. Where do you stand on that view? Of making your time count.
Well, absolutely. You've got to stand up for what you believe in.
That it's not just about winning elections, it's about doing things.
It's about doing things. And I think, you know, the people of this state have put their trust in me and they've put their trust in me three times now to do the best for them and their families. And that's what I keep intending to do.
So Dianne Feinstein, it's interesting you pull her out of it because I was a correspondent. I was about to say young correspondent, but that's not entirely true. I was a correspondent in the United States, based in California, in fact, when Dianne Feinstein was mayor. And I reported on really quite a pivotal moment in social policy globally when Dianne Feinstein decided as a mayor to prohibit smoking in offices and in restaurants. And boy, did she go against the grain to do that. I mean, a lot of people responded to it, but she met enormous opposition on that.
Mm.
She put herself right out there. Have you had moments when you've put yourself right out there on a policy issue? I mean, really put yourself out on the edge?
Well, I think I did during the campaign where I said that this term we were going to tackle the issue of voluntary assisted dying. That's a deeply personal issue for a lot of people, and
it's about time that Parliament took a vote on that. So that'll be coming in during the middle half of this year for people to... and I've come out publicly and said that I support it.
So what prompted you to do that? Was there a personal element in this?
Yeah, there is. Absolutely. Absolutely. A couple of things. So the first thing was many, many years ago when my grandfather passed away, he had a very sad passing with terminal cancer. And then when my grandmother departed, she was in pain at the end, but not for a long period of time. And I've been thinking about it, and people have been approaching me and talking to me about it as well. And it just firmed up in my mind that you really need to have control over what you want to do at the end of your life. It is a big ask of people, but at the end of the day, it's your decision. It's a very personal decision. And I think we get in a situation where a lot of families sometimes don't know what their loved one wants to do. And then my uncle tragically passed away last year, 3 months after, 3 to 4 months after my grandmother, with terminal cancer. And he had a very slow and agonising death.
What do you say to those who, for out of strong religious conviction themselves would say, this is all part of God's plan, that that you can die with dignity while in pain, but your life should run its course?
So we've also going to put in, carry over $170 million in improving palliative care services. So people can choose to die with dignity in their own homes as well, to give that extra support. But, you know, I consider myself a Catholic. I consider myself a Christian. And, you know, I also had to make a decision earlier on too about for our voting for in the last term on the termination of pregnancy, which I also supported, you know, probably 25 years after the US made that decision, which is pivotal because no one should tell another woman what to do with her own body.
Are you conscious too that such is the feeling around that issue that you would never be able to relax, no legislator would ever be able to relax once having felt that they had won the point and that what you've described is enshrined in law? Because the resistance is never going to go away, is it?
I think
will always be people who will want to turn that back.
There may be people who want to, but I think what you'll find and what we found with the termination of pregnancy bill, it had support from members across the political divide, and I think you'll find with dying with dignity, I think you'll actually find too that there'll be people across the political spectrum, and I think when you have that, it's less polarising.
Very briefly, you haven't mentioned Peter Beattie amongst your favourite leaders. But in electoral terms, he was very successful for a long time. And I've heard his approach described by former staff as being make a big deal publicly over bread and butter decisions like, say, more police stations or more new schools, while implementing policies that might be less popular with a socially conservative state with as little fanfare as possible. Does that resonate with you?
No. Well, look, I used to work in Peter Beattie's government, so I'm not going to criticise. And, look, he did a great job as Premier. And also, he did a great job in helping to deliver the Commonwealth Games, which was here on the Gold Coast. So I have nothing but respect for Peter and the work that he's done for Queensland.
I wasn't really implying otherwise, but
yeah.
Perhaps it was just minor mischief on my part. Yeah. What I was really interested
in... A little bit of mischief.
What I was really interested in was the proposition that the style, the Beattie style, was to play up the populist issues while essentially, not sneaking through, but while essentially underplaying the issues that he knew might strike a bad chord with socially conservative Queensland. Is that the kind of game you have to play in a state that is perceived to be socially conservative?
Well, I might give you an example of something that was put in the too hard basket in the Beattie government and something that we did. So this was the issue of taking 17-year-olds out of the adult corrective system. Every other state and territory had done it. Queensland was the last one to do it. Why didn't Queensland do it? Every single time the bureaucracy would say, it's too much money, it's too much money, it's too much money. But it was a breach of international human rights. So it took a courageous government to actually make that decision and do it. But not only did we do that, we also put $550 million into our youth justice system as well. Now, that's going to roll out over 4 years. We're starting to see some early results of that. We're not going to see all of it at once, but it's the largest injection that has been put into youth justice in a generation.
Now, when we're talking about youth justice, we're predominantly talking about Indigenous youth justice. And we know how much the deck is stacked against Indigenous Australians broadly, including Indigenous youth inside the justice system. And you saw Mick Gooda's response overnight to your reaction yesterday to the latest pressure on youth crime, I think particularly in Townsville, but not just confined to Townsville. And he described it as a knee-jerk reaction. He said he wasn't turning his back on the problem, but he was saying it was a knee-jerk reaction and that kind of punishment in the end doesn't work, that you've got to find other ways.
And we are finding other ways. So we announced some tough and strong measures, about the 10% that the police are advising us that are committing the majority of the offences. In the 90%, we are starting to see good results. And in terms
first
of...
first offenders?
If you get in early,
yeah,
and prevent it, you're going to stop the repeat offending. So we had an example out in Mount Isa where a young girl who was offending went and did some programs. We got her into, I think it was numeracy and literacy programs, and had a mentor, got some mental health assistance, hasn't reoffended since January last year. We've got on-country programs. Now, this is really important because what the elders were saying to me is that we want to take our young kids and we want them to understand country. We want them to go onto our land and we want to spend time with them and tell them about our history and our culture. And we've had 73 people go through that program and very, very few have reoffended. So we need to do more of that. We need more support for people. And sometimes it's a lack of diagnosis of mental health. It is a very complex situation, but that money we've put aside there, that $550 million, is going to a whole different programs right across the state, which we are confident that we will see that youth crime decrease from that age group.
Since we're talking Indigenous issues, you know my interest in
in
what you're going to do with the Pathway to Treaty recommendations that went to the Parliament and which were embraced by your government. And this is for a whole set of steps essentially to reconcile with Indigenous Queenslanders for a dreadful past.
Whatever
good things have come from the past, the horrors of the history of colonial times, particularly in Queensland, I would be dare to stick my neck out and say as bad as anywhere else in Australia and worse than many other areas. How important a priority is it for you to follow that process, to actually establish an institute, to actually establish a truth-telling process, to establish a genuine pathway, not just to a treaty, but quite possibly treaties? And how importantly do you embrace or how energetically do you embrace the concept of a voice to a state parliament? Not necessarily enshrined in a constitution here, but a genuine voice to parliament, which is a part of the review process of policy that might affect Indigenous issues.
All right. Well, this is something I'm very passionate about, so I'm happy to elaborate a little bit on that. So first of all, in terms of voices, we have three very strong voices in our party and in the government. We've got Leanne Enoch, who is a minister and a very, very good minister. We've got Lance, who's been elected for Bundamba, and we have the first ever Torres Strait Islander person elected to the Queensland Parliament in Cynthia Louis.
But let me very quickly interrupt there. These people will come and go. What we're talking about is permanent, a permanent structure that can't shift, a permanent structure that becomes a big part of the future of Queensland and changes the story.
Well, that's a conversation the whole nation needs to have.
But all the states in the end will be the implementers. Yeah, and this is your opportunity, I would have thought.
Well, can we talk about treaty? So in terms of treaty, this is absolutely fundamental. I think we have to acknowledge the past. We have to do truth-telling. I've just signed off on the committee that will be travelling around the state where people can come forward and tell their stories about what happened. And the history of Queensland, the history of Australia, it's not a pretty history. People, Indigenous people, had their wages stolen. They were not paid. And they helped contribute to building our state. We put in $21 million to pay back some of those stolen wages. And there was a court case where I think it was around $160 million. Then we need to acknowledge that there were massacres that happened, that our country was invaded. And I think we need to be a lot stronger in telling that history in our schools.
How much of the history have you read yourself as a personal thing? I mean, what do you know of the role of the native police in exterminating Indigenous people in the second half of the 19th century? And are you across the work of Lyndall Ryan at Newcastle University and the map of massacres that she's been building assiduously over the last few years? I mean, are you right into that story yourself?
Well, Kerry, I was in the British Library when I was doing my master's many years ago, and it took me to be seated in the British Library reading a court case about the Mile Creek Massacre in northern New South Wales. Mm. Now, back then, the squatters wanted to get the land, and they were able to get the land if there was deemed to be no one living on that land. So people were rounded up and they were killed and they were massacred. And back then at the time, I was horrified to be reading all of this detail. And in fact, it was the British government back then, the colonial office, who was actually telling people here in Australia that there should be a treaty with people. And they were absolutely horrified that the people who were deemed to have done this were let off. And to read this in the British Library was just unbelievable. And when I first met Chris Sarah, he came in to my office and he was talking to me about a treaty. And this was very early.
This is Chris, who was the head of the Indigenous Affairs Department.
I've appointed as head of the... Yeah, exactly. And I value his input and the work that he is doing. But also what we're doing is we're actually, my ministers go out to Indigenous communities with their Director General and they listen to their concerns and they respond to them. And we also meet with the mayors once every 6 months as well to listen to their concern.
I'm not an expert on this at all, but I have a sense that the education on Indigenous history and culture and tradition through the various services like health and the justice system is piecemeal. I'm not just talking about Queensland, I'm talking generally. And yet that kind of education process is fundamental because they are the front line of services, of delivery of services to Indigenous people, Indigenous communities. And it is the police who are the front line of the justice system. And you just have a sense that there are so many police still who have no sense of the injustices that have gone before them, as they are a part of a system which is still locking an obscene number of Indigenous people up in this country. Are you confident that you have those processes in place in this state, and if you don't, that you will make sure that they are?
I think we are growing the competency. My understanding is that first-year constables training actually does include conversations.
But how much? Is it a week? You know, is it a week out of...
Well, of course, it always needs to be more.
Yeah.
But I think we also need more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders as part of our police force. I think at the moment it's about 2%. That needs to be more. We've got about 160 or 130 police liaison officers. But absolutely there needs to be an understanding. And, you know, as a nation we need to do more. As a nation we need to have constitutional recognition. That's step one. Mm. If you're going to unite a country, you have to bring everyone together. You can't go down the next path unless everyone's united.
Don't depress me. With the time that's left, the brief time that's left, we don't really have any actually, but I cannot let climate change go unmentioned. And in terms of leadership, you've set a target to cut carbon emissions by, quote unquote, at least 30% by 2030. Now, there's nothing particularly ambitious about it. That is there because, and even if you achieve that, even if you achieve that, for a start, the most credible climate change scientists on the planet are clearly saying that 30% Paris targets are way short of what's required to limit temperatures to the targets they're talking about, even 2%. Some are predicting that it'll get to 1.5% Celsius increase in temperature in 4 years. Now, you trusted the experts on the pandemic and you've talked about what a great outcome that was. You've said that you've made a point of trusting your experts. If you actually opened your ears and your eyes to all of the experts amongst the climate science, surely you would be doing more than you're doing in Queensland, one of the great emitters and one of the great exporters of emissions.
Well, climate change is real. It's happening. You don't need to go to the Pacific Islands. I've been up to some of the Torres Strait Islands where we're building seawalls because of what's happening. I've been there personally. I've sat down with people. I'm investing because it is unimaginable to me that our islands are facing, a global problem. It'd be good if we had a federal government that was prepared to take action.
But let's just talk about what you can do in Queensland and what the other states are doing. New South Wales, a conservative state, the minister, the environment minister there has got a 35% target for 2030. You've got a 30% target. Victoria, the committee that they empowered to tell them what their target should be, came back with the target of 45% to 60% by 2030. You're 30%.
Yeah, well, we've got 50% renewable energy target by 2030. Mm. Before we came to office, we had 7% renewable energy. In 6 years, we're now at 20%, and we will get to our 30%.
Can you do better, do you think, than 30% cuts in emissions by 2030?
Well, we're going to have to do everything we possibly can. We are, but in terms of...
Why can't you do better? Just very practically, why can't you do better than a 30% cut? Why can't you go hard for something better than that? Is it political that the mining industry and that those who are opposed, some of whom still don't believe in the climate science, that is their voice too strong?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, where I started off earlier talking about hydrogen, we know that the world is looking for alternative uses, and hydrogen is clearly a part of that. And Queensland has the opportunity, as the Sunshine State, to export our sunshine to the rest of the world.
What's better about we've got more sunshine than Victorians, but we're not. It's not like we've got a monopoly on sunshine. Why is that a particular Queensland thing?
Why is it a particular Queensland thing?
Why would hydrogen be Not exclusively, but why is it more attractive in Queensland than, say, the top half of New South Wales, which would get as much sun as you get in the bottom half of Queensland, I would have thought?
Because we're getting investors that are coming here wanting to set up, okay? So
while other investors are pulling out in terms of the fossil fuels broadly in Australia, and Queensland is being targeted.
Okay, so
that's the last time I'll interrupt.
No, we have coal, we have gas, and we have renewables, right? So we have all three. We have the youngest coal-fired power fleet in the nation. We have gas, and now we have a very large investment in renewables. And a lot of that is private investment. We've also set up CleanCo, a renewable energy company, which the government has set up. So we are actually absolutely working on making sure that we are addressing fundamental issues of climate change.
But do you believe the great mass of climate scientists who tell you we don't even have the time that you're planning on? We do not have that time. We just don't. There are those who believe we are going to reach a tipping point beyond which there is no real return. I mean, do you accept this is a genuine existential threat?
Oh, absolutely. Of course I do. I mean, who doesn't? I mean, who here in the audience does not believe in climate change?
No, that's not the question. It's about how far you have to go to actually deal with it.
But we are going as fast as we possibly can. I mean, we have got $15 billion of investment happening in Queensland on the books and happening, wind farms that weren't here 6 years ago, solar farms that weren't here 6 years ago, and people wanting to invest in the new economy minerals in the Northwest Minerals Province for things such as batteries and storage. I mean, we've got the resources here to do the manufacture as well. And as you see, the next 20 years with the phase out of some motor vehicles in terms of it'll now be electric or hydrogen, we are at the forefront and we can benefit from that.
So many other things I wanted to talk to you about tonight, Anastasia, but I'm going to go to the end. A good leader should also know when it's time to go. And our political history is littered with the bones of leaders who stayed too long. I know you're a long way away from that. Very few walk away of their own volition. How will you know, ultimately, when it's time to go?
We've just had an election, Kerry.
I know, but it's an interesting point, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
Look, you could
it
be
is.
Here for another 8 or 9 or 10 years.
I'll be here as long as the people of Queensland want me to be here.
Yeah.
And I'll know.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And you'll still be young as leaders go when this term ends. What is the one thing...
Well, 50 is the new 30, isn't it?
75. 75 is the new 72. At the end of the day, what's more important, how long you've held on to power or an enduring legacy to leave behind?
I think it's about the people and it's what I can do, and I can only do it to the best of my ability. What you see is what you get.
They seem to like it so far. Anastasia Palaszczuk, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to A Better Future for All in conversation with Kerry O'Brien from Griffith University. Produced by Eddie Nalwafer and edited by Michael Adams and Andrew Thompson. Visit betterfuture.griffith.edu.au to keep up to date with our upcoming events or catch up on our past events on demand.